Welcome, everybody. This is Matt Monarch with the Conscious Parenting Summit, and we've got an extremely special guest for you today, and we're going to be talking about her expertise, which is unschooling and a few other things also. And we have Jan Hunt here. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yes, and you have a psychology major on this subject?
Yes, I have a master's degree in psychology, counseling, actually. And I have, my son is 31 now and unschooled from the beginning.
Wow. You know, I keep having this recurring dream, and I'm going to tell you about it really quickly. I had it last night, as a matter of fact, but it was just because you were going to be on. I keep having this dream over and over again that I'm in finals or something, and I know none of the information that I'm supposed to for these tests. Like, I haven't been to school for, like, days or something. And it's like this ongoing fear of some sort. Like, I don't know. What do you think about that?
I have that dream all the time. I think our brain is still trying to process all that fear that we had all when we were in school about tests coming up. Were we really prepared well enough? All of those fears, all of that anxiety, I think that's how we're processing it, because that's what sleep does, you know, it processes our experiences.
Right. And so you have 31 years of experience with unschooling, which I've read, and then you're also author of The Nature Child.
The Natural Child.
The Natural Child, yeah.
We have three books. My parenting book is The Natural Child, Parenting from the Heart, and my children's book, which is very similar in theme on attachment parenting, but written as a children's book to reach the next generation of parents. It's just a fun children's book, but it includes all of the recommendations that I make for parenting are in the illustrations. So it shows breastfeeding, it shows co-sleeping, you know, like that.
Right.
And then my son and I, a couple of years ago, co-edited a collection of essays on unschooling called The Unschooling Unmanual. And all of these books are available on our website, which is naturalchild.org.
Yeah, I was actually on your website. Everybody should check this out. It's www.naturalchild.org. And there's amazing articles on there, and I love the quotes that you have every month. I think it's just very awesome, and I've actually bookmarked it so I could read these quotes.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So I'm excited about this interview because I feel like I'm going to learn a lot, because I have no experience with this. My child is just over 3 months old now. And
well, then he's already then you're already unschooling. Because really, whenever anyone asks me what the definition of unschooling is, mm-hmm. I say that what unschoolers do is exactly what all parents do. All loving parents, what they do with their child until he's of so-called school age. You know, if a two-year-old gets interested in trains, what does the parent do? He gets a book about trains. He takes him for a train ride. He buys him a toy train. You know, he talks about it. He sees if the child has any particular questions about it. And that goes on. And the child shares what his interests are. You know, you never have to guess what a two-year-old is interested in. They'll let you know. In age three and age four, it just continues. But then all of a sudden, he's, quote, school age. And so the assumption is that at that point, he's learning in a completely different way, and now he needs teachers, and he has to sit still, and he has to take tests and all of that, or he won't learn. But he has been learning so much, learn how to talk, how to walk, learning so much. The vast majority of what a child knows he learned in his first few years, the most difficult things. You know, they say the English language is one of the most difficult languages to learn. They don't have any problem. They learn it because they're listening to it and they're surrounded by it. And so that's the only difference. It's, you're already unschooling, according to my definition. Okay.
Wow. That's beautiful. So I have this feeling that, you know, when the time comes, like, I'm just going to continue to do what I'm doing. I'm not even going to think of school or anything. I'm just going to live life and not even deal with it. Like, even homeschooling, I feel, is – maybe you could talk about the difference between homeschooling and unschooling, because I'm not even into that. I'm just, like, wanting to live.
Mm-hmm. Well, the difference is that homeschooling is more like school, in that people who homeschool in a conservative way, they use textbooks, they use curriculum. You know, they'll find a curriculum that they like and set up classes. I mean, there's a range of you know, homeschooling from one extreme to the other. Some parents actually have English at 9 and math at 10 and, you know, like that. So they're actually setting up school at home, and so it's called homeschooling. Unschooling is very, very different from that. We trust that the child knows the curriculum. The curriculum is in the child's head. He's the only one who knows what he's interested in at that moment. And children learn best what they're interested in. But no teacher in a school could possibly meet that kind of need. You know, how can you meet the needs of 10 or 20 or 30 children, you know, every one of whom has a very specific interest at that moment? It would take forever to even determine what those interests are, let alone try to meet them.
Right.
So they don't. You know, they don't. Of course, the assumption is that the teacher knows best, that the child's current interest is not important. He's just a child. But the teacher says, I know what's important. I'm the one who knows what he should be learning at this moment, and he'd better learn it by the time he's X age old, you know. And it's so strange, because we don't have that approach when we have infants. You know, no one says to their child, you'd better learn to walk by Wednesday.
Right.
they assume that the child will walk. They're trusting that Mother Nature has built in a desire to grow up, you know, and to do what grown-ups do. And so the child, you know, wants to stand up and wants to walk. I mean, they try so hard. They can fall down a million times, and they still keep trying. They're so motivated, you know. And teachers always ask me, well, how do you motivate a child? Well, you don't have to motivate a child. You just have to trust that they are motivated, and trust that whatever they're motivated to do is what they should, in fact, be doing right at that moment. It's just all about trust. In fact, John Holt, and he's the author that I most highly recommend, but John Holt said, you can take every one of my books, and he wrote numerous books, he said, you can take every one of my books and boil it down to two words, trust children.
Wow.
And if you can trust that the child knows what he wants, that the child's built-in curriculum is the best one for him, and that his built-in timetable is the best one for him, and if you can just trust that, then that's what will happen. He'll move along on his own timetable. And sometimes it can look very different from what school thinks should be the timetable. You know, they have all these timetables about when a child should do this and should do that, and they should learn the numbers by this date, and they should know the times tables by that date, and they should learn to read by this date. And all of that is so arbitrary and unnecessary and harmful, very harmful, because those children whose natural timetables don't happen to coincide with what the school thinks they should be, that child is criticized, is made to feel that he's a failure, could be teased by other kids, and so on. And it's just so, it's really, really sad. It makes me very sad when I hear stories about those children. And it makes me very happy when I hear about other children, because I want to put this in definitely in this interview, talk about Grant Colfax. The Colfax family was one of the very first unschoolers. It wasn't even called unschooling at that point. In fact, when we first started, it was called organic homeschooling or John Holt homeschooling, you know. But the Colfax family, this is way back. This is like in the 70s. They have four boys. They're all adopted. They lived in Northern California. They had a ranch there, and they unschooled from the beginning. I believe it was from the beginning, all four. And the oldest boy, Grant, he decided to, when he was a teenager, to apply to college. So he took the college boards, and I believe that was the very first test he'd ever taken. And he did well enough that he was accepted at Harvard. He went to Harvard, and he graduated with honors.
Wow.
And then he went through Harvard Medical School and graduated with honors. And he's now a very top-level medical researcher in the country. The same thing with the next two boys. They also graduated from Harvard Medical and Harvard Law. And the fourth boy decided not to go to college. He's doing things that didn't need a college degree. But Grant, the first one, after we had all known his story and after we knew that he graduated with honors from Harvard and so on, he admitted or told us that he didn't learn to read until he was 9 years old.
Wow.
And I actually got chills when I heard that, because I thought if he had been in school, he would have felt like a failure. You know, he would have been probably put in special classes. You know, he would just have been criticized for it, and his parents might have been worried about it for nothing, for no reason. There would have been no reason for that, because he did, in fact, learn to read at 9, and I'm sure he's a good reader now. He's a medical researcher. So it's completely unnecessary, all of these artificial timetables that schools have. All they do is cause problems, unnecessary problems. Woodrow Wilson, he was homeschooled. I don't know how much of an unschooling it was, but he was homeschooled. He didn't learn to read till he was 11.
Wow.
You know? And obviously that was okay. You know, he went on to do great things, and it's just a shame. All of these artificial timetables, they should all just be, you know, let go.
Yeah, now that I reflect, back in the day when I was in school, everything seemed so serious, and it's mm-hmm. like this was so serious. I feel like if I would have just never went to school or college or anything, I would have done, I'd be doing even more better than I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Because unschoolers, we always talk all the time about how much fun it is, you know, and we're all, you know, the whole 31 years, you know, every day was full of joy and laughter and fun. And that's how it should be. You know, John Holt said, one of my favorite John Holt quotes, he said, "When we make a child afraid, we stop learning dead in its tracks."
Wow.
And that's absolutely true. Fear interferes with learning. Of course it does. We all know, even as adults, how when we're afraid about something is making us fearful, we can't concentrate on anything very well. You know,
right.
We can't focus. But children are made to feel afraid. They're afraid of the grade that they're going to get. They're afraid of what the teacher's going to say to them. They're afraid of what the other kids are going to do to them. And it's just all this fear makes it impossible, really, to learn at the optimum rate that a child should learn.
And then at 37 years old, they start having nightmares about not being prepared
exactly.
for finals.
Yeah, exactly. It's Well, it's amazing we any of us survived. You know? Really. Yeah.
So I know you mentioned this one graduate from Harvard and, you know, their mm-hmm. siblings. What kind of differences do you see in general with unschooled children versus homeschooling and children that are in schools?
Oh, there's so many. The very first difference that we noticed when we first started meeting other unschoolers was that children are not afraid of adults. Unschooled children are comfortable with adults. They're comfortable with any age. They can happily play with a baby. They can comfortably talk with their parents' friends. They can comfortably talk with the elderly gentleman next door, you know. There's no age, you know, that's the other thing that schools do. They think that you can only learn well with other people your own age, and that's, you know, adults don't do that. We have friends of different ages, and We don't think I can, I have to be with people who are within 12 months of my age.
Right.
You know. I'm sorry, what was your question? I got a little.
Yeah, that's awesome. I want the differences of, in children that are, you know.
Oh, right, thank you. Okay, so that's one. They're comfortable with all ages. Number two is they're just happier. They're happier kids. They don't have a lot of resentment and anger that, that can come out in aggressive ways. So they're very much easier to get along with. That's, I always say, if nothing else, the one benefit of unschooling is that you can meet other unschoolers and that your child can meet other unschooling children.
Ah.
Because they're not going to be teasing them. I have a client who about a year ago decided to unschool, and her child had had a really, really miserable time in school and was teased even by the teacher and by other kids. A terrible situation. And she'd also had trouble, you know, socially too in general, outside of school. But as soon as they started unschooling and started meeting other unschooling children, wow, you know, now she's so happy. She has so many friends who are, she doesn't have to worry about what they're going to say to her or what they're going to do to her. They just, they're happy. They're having fun together. It's just beautiful.
Wow, that's awesome. Any other differences that you could think of?
Yes, well, the difference that sort of ties in with the big college question is that when an unschooled child goes to college, which is very easy nowadays because Harvard actually is looking for unschoolers, and lots of other colleges have accepted unschoolers and homeschoolers because they know they make the best students. And so this is the other difference, is that when you're allowed to follow your own intuitions and your own motivations and stay on your own timetable, you're learning about yourself, which you can't really do in school because
Right. You're
not supposed to be different. You're supposed to be like everyone else. So unschoolers especially, but also homeschoolers, they just know more about their own interests. They know more what pleases them. They know more what their skills are. So by the time they go to college, they are there for a reason. If, you know, like the fourth Colfax boy, if they don't need it, they don't go. If they do want it, if there's something that they want to do, or as John Holt says, they need a key to open a door, you know, the Grant Colfax couldn't have become a doctor without college. So if they go, they're there for a very specific reason. They're there not just to get that key to get a profession, but they're there also to learn.
Yeah.
And they know what they want to learn, and they have less difficulty determining what to major in, because they know themselves so well, so much better than a school child does. And so they do very, very well in college. And now it's actually a kind of ironic that there's so many families who are doing the opposite, you know, going the opposite route, because they want their child to have a good career, want their child to go to a good college. And so what do? They send them to a very expensive preschool and a very expensive kindergarten, you know, get in the very best private schools and so on. And really, the very best and easiest way is to just unschool. You know, if you have a child who's unschooled their whole life, they won't have any trouble getting in college. They'll be welcomed.
Right. It seems like blatantly obvious to me, but a lot of people, you know, they're brought up like in schools, and this is what's normal, and this is what needs to happen, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So before we move on to the next question, can you think of any more differences, or?
No,
that's
but
okay.
If I do think of one, I'll mention it.
Okay, cool. Okay, so since most people, I mean, to me, again, I said it was blatantly obvious, but many people in the, you know, people are always criticizing, like, homeschooling, even like, let alone unschooling. Like, there's not enough socializing for the child. There's not enough structure. The
mm-hmm.
child will always want to get its own way and so on. And mm-hmm. what do you say to people who criticize this sort of thing?
Well, they just don't know. I tell them to read our book, The Unschooling Unmanual, and has, you know, essays from I don't know, 9 or 10 families who have unschooled, and it's kind of an eye opener for a lot of people to see how it actually does work. You know, it's all of their fears are completely groundless. You know, in the first place, school was not supposed to be for socialization. I don't know when that came in, that they decided that school was supposed to be for socialization, but it makes no sense to me because of the kind of socialization that goes on there, that John Holt said that if for no other reason to homeschool, that socialization would be that reason. If you have no other reason, that's enough. That's a sufficient reason because of the kind of socialization that takes place. It's very, very petty, you know, who went to whose birthday party and who has new clothes, and very shallow and petty. And all of these children, all the children who are there are frustrated and fearful. So it's not a very good setup for socializing or for learning about socialization with other people who are afraid and unhappy.
Right.
But you don't really need a lot of experiences with other kids to socialize. In fact, you don't really need any. Because here's an extreme example. There was a boy who grew up in Alaska with his parents, and they were very isolated. The father was a field researcher of some type, and he wrote to Growing Without Schooling, which was the John Holt's newsletter that we all had, and it was very much like an internet blog, except that it was a printed, mailed newsletter, and we would send letters, you know, with stamps. And they would get printed the next month. I mean, very, very slow compared to the internet. But it was very interesting. And we got to hear stories from other unschooling families. And so they had one issue devoted to socialization. And the next issue, they printed a letter that had come from a young man who was in college at the time. And he said, I think my story might be helpful. He said, I grew up in Alaska. Just the three of us, my parents, I'm an only child, and for most of the year we were completely isolated, except when supply planes came in, and that's how I grew up, he said, and now I'm in college, and when I tell my friends this story, they're shocked, you know, they say, well, but you are the nicest person we know, you are so easy to get along with, you're such a friendly, wonderful, warm person. How did you learn to do that? And he said, my parents are good people. You know, we can learn socialization from our parents, and we should. We should have parents who teach us by example what a good person is like, what a good, friendly, warm, helpful, sharing person is like.
Right.
So we don't really need any. We certainly don't need 30. You know, no adult has 30, we don't have 30 friends as adults. We don't.
Right.
And if we were if we were going to meetings of some kind that had 30 people in it, we wouldn't expect to be good friends with all 30 people.
Right. I mean, I think about it. I mean, I had one older brother. You know, we were both schooled, whatever. And you know, he used to beat me up. And now I think about going to school. It's like, you know, there'd be people that would pick on me. It's like. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I know. I'm a small person, and I also skipped a grade. Unfortunately, it really didn't do me any good because that meant that I was even smaller than everybody else, and
right.
I was constantly called shrimp and you know made fun of and everything. And unschooling kids would never do that kind of thing. They wouldn't dream of it.
Right.
They wouldn't need to express their frustrations in that way. They wouldn't be that frustrated.
Right.
I read a very funny little thing. I think it was on the internet. A woman said that a relative was asking her about socialization, and she said, "Well, there's a school right down the block. Why don't you go down there and spend some time there and tell me what behaviors you see that you think I should help my child learn?"
Yeah.
Because we all know what we would see in any school. You know,
right.
We'd see negative behavior, aggression.
Yeah.
You know, frustration leads to aggression. That was the very first lesson I was given in graduate school. You know, frustration leads to aggression. So if we see someone who's aggressive, you know, we know that they're frustrated. They have a
right.
need that hasn't been met. They have their needs are not being met. Their emotional needs, their physical needs, whatever.
Right. So what are your thoughts about unschooling in a modern context where the parents may not be doing anything very interesting or stimulating for the child? For example, they might be working at a computer rather than out in the fields making houses or gardening, etc.
Hmm. Interesting question. Well, I guess my first thought is it's a new world. You know, we're in the information age and children are wanting to spend time on computers because that's what we have now. That's what our culture is doing now. And I don't think we should be afraid of it. You know, if you look back in history, you'll see a lot of people writing about very anguished about the fact that their children are listening to the radio so much. You know, in the
right.
40s. And in the 50s,
wow.
It was television, and now it's the internet. You know, we're always afraid of the future, but this is the future is here now. And however, I do want to say that what I share with parents who are concerned about children who are spending a lot of time on a computer is definitely not to limit it, not to use force in any way to get them away from that, but instead to offer alternatives, you know, because there are some legitimate concerns. You know, if a child's on the computer all day, he's not getting vitamin D and sunshine, you know, and exercise and so on. So that's what I did. You know, Jason was spending a lot of time on the computer. I would kind of remind him and say, hey, would you like to go for a walk? It's a beautiful day out now, and you know, like that, and try to balance that out.
Right.
You know, but And the parents aren't the only ones involved. I mean, they'll have, you know, if you don't have a garden, maybe you can have friends who have a garden, you know. It's not completely on their shoulders. It's a group effort, and especially if there's a support group, which I highly recommend to find a support group, then any skills that you're missing or any activities that you're not doing, you know, other families might be doing. And so you have help, you have support that way.
Right. Okay. There's another question that I want to know. So, for example, we're getting all these baby books from friends and family as gifts and stuff like that, and it almost seems like a dumbing down in a sense. It's like so basic and like with pictures and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like also another example is like children's songs. They're so basic, and you know, I'm just wondering like what content should we give? I mean, should we be like limiting them to children's books, or can we like literally just break out, you know, novels or whatever? Like, what content would you suggest?
Well, there are some wonderful children's books out there, though.
Cool.
I can send you a list. Jason had 5 favorite children's authors when he was little, and we had to read every single word they ever wrote. We did all kinds of interlibrary loans. James Marshall was his number one author, and four or five other ones. There are good children's books. There are a lot of really dumb books, lots of very dumb children's books, lots of dumb parenting books. It's just a question of finding the better ones, you know.
Okay.
And that's where a support group can be really helpful, too. If you're talking with an unschooling family who have children are a little older than yours, they would have lots of good suggestions. And, of course, on the Internet now, it's so easy to find, you know, reviews in Amazon and reviews on blogs, you know, like that, to find really good recommendations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have no experience with this. I'm just curious, and that's why I'm like asking about children's books. I'm not like saying everybody children's books are bad. I'm just wanting to get people's views on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have book recommendations on our website, actually, children's books, and it's just under resources and then book reviews.
Do you have John Holt's books there too?
Do I have John Holt's books?
On your website.
Oh, of course, yeah. Well, they're recommended. Absolutely. It was one of John Holt's books that convinced us when Jason was about two. We read How Children Learn, and that is the one book that every parent should read, whether or not they want to unschool or not. This is the book that really does answer the question, how does a child learn? It's a very, very short and sweet, and it's a wonderful, fun book to read, very, absolutely crystal clear on that subject. If you read that book and you finish the book, you'll know how children learn.
Wow.
And then if that book convinces you to unschool like it did us, then his book, Teach Your Own, which was recently revised, is the how-to book. You know, okay, I want to unschool. Now what do I do? And so the Teach Your Own has a lot of good advice in there. But every one of John Holt's books, we have numerous quotes by him in our quote section. All of his books and articles, he was just such a clear writer and a beautiful writer. Just very, as a writer myself, I'm always so impressed with the rhythm of his sentences. It's just so comfortable. It's just such an easy read. Even on tough subjects, it's just very easy and fun to read him.
Nice. I'm actually at your website right now. Again, everybody, it's www.naturalchild.org. And this is a really good website. Like, it has so much information, resources. I noticed there was an urgent message to your readers on here about, you're saying there's some, I mean, if you look at the quotes, it looks like you've been doing this for many, many years because you had a quote every month.
We started in 1996.
Right. 1996,
yeah. Yeah. And then we were... we've had a problem ever since the recession of just keeping going. So we're asking for donations, and we're getting donations, and people want to make sure that we stay there, that we continue our work.
Oh, that's awesome. And if anybody else wants to donate, they can go to naturalchild.org, and you'll be able to check that out. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then I wanted to ask you, maybe you could give tips for people wanting to choose an alternative path and feeling criticism from family and friends, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. How to handle criticism?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, because a lot of people, it's almost like even when you eat a new diet, everybody's like saying you're doing everything wrong and your family and your friends and stuff like that.
Yeah, and unschooling is relatively new and it's growing by leaps and bounds, but it's still, a minority, obviously, of the child population. Well, it's the same as with any other kind of criticism of parenting. It's just a question of being tactful and using, I would recommend learning about nonviolent communication, which is a way of expressing your needs and feelings and being heard and learning how to hear other people's needs and feelings. And if you focus on needs and feelings, it's much easier than the way we normally handle criticism. But one thing to remember with alternative education and alternative parenting, for that matter, is the proof is in the pudding. My parents were very, very critical of our attachment parenting, co-sleeping and longer breastfeeding and so on. Highly critical. I was really very unhappy with that part of our life. But over the years, as they saw Jason grow up and saw what a terrific child he is and how much he was learning and how bright he was and how happy and how giving he was as a person, the criticism, as that built up, then the criticism went down because all of their anxieties were relieved. You know, they were so afraid that he would never read, but then one day he was reading. You know, they were so afraid that he wouldn't get along with other children, and then they saw that he could. And all of those fears, one by one, you know, fell by the wayside because they could see that it was working. So by the time he was,
right,
I don't know, 6 or 7 or so, you know, it was much, much less. It just got much less. But looking back, I wish I had known about nonviolent communication. I don't know if it was even around at that point, but I sure wish it had been, because I it would have made things a lot easier in talking with my parents and about their feelings. You know, are you afraid that he'll never learn to read? Well, let me give you some examples of other children, or you know, I can see that it would have been a lot easier for me than just simply getting upset with them.
Where's a good place for people to learn about nonviolent communication? Because it's such a key thing.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up right now and get the URL right. Okay. Here it is.
Okay.
Okay.
Once you,
it is. Yeah. It's cnvc.org.
Ah. Okay.
And we also carry the main book, Nonviolent Communication. We also carry a couple of wonderful little booklets, because nonviolent communication is applied in every field, not just parenting or education. It's used in politics and in business and in every area. But there are two booklets that we carry in our shop, which is Parenting from the Heart, and what was the other one? I'll have to look. But we carry two booklets that look at parenting issues from a nonviolent communication perspective. And so these are very small little booklets, very inexpensive. They're just worth their weight in gold. I always recommend those to my clients. It makes it easy to learn about nonviolent communication in general, too, from those booklets. But they're specifically about parenting. There's the large book we also carry, but that covers every area that it's used in.
Right. I was also wondering, there's another topic that I wanted to cover with you, and you actually just briefly talked about it, co-sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well,
a lot of people, yeah.
Co-sleeping is what we all did for millions, hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah.
It's the norm. Relatively, very, very recently, in relative terms, did people stop co-sleeping, and not everyone either. Still, the vast majority of children on the planet co-sleep. You know, China, Japan, lots of children co-sleep. India. Okay, here's a little story. A friend of mine is a professor at Harvard, and he went to a luncheon with other professors. And somehow they got onto the topic of co-sleeping, you know, whether it was acceptable. And so he was listening to all these people talk about, well, maybe if she's ill, you know, maybe if she had a nightmare, it might be okay.
Wow.
And he was just shocked. He was just stunned, you know. And he said, and so he listened to all of them, and then he said, you know, I can't believe what I'm hearing. He said, I slept with my arm around my dad until I left home in 22.
Wow.
And then he said, and now my dad and I are best friends. I call him at least once a day. And this is from the U.S. to India. I call him at least once a day. I can't wait to see him again. We get along so well. And then he said it was interesting that then the topic at the luncheon changed to all these people talking about how they weren't even speaking to their parents, some of them.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just, that's the number one benefit of co-sleeping, is that it helps the family bond, and it helps siblings bond. And it's funny because you think, well, you're asleep, what do you know? Well, you know a lot. In fact, just recently they have research showing how much of our brain is still awake when we're sleeping. We're very much aware of that. And children, so the child who's co-sleeping feels secure, and when they wake up, they're not frightened. They're less likely to cry just because they've woken up, because they're not waking up alone. They, you know, Jason woke up lots, but he would just sometimes just look over at me and then go back to sleep, just kind of reassuring himself I'm still there. You know.
I got emotional.
It's the one thing I most miss in parenting, co-sleeping.
I got emotional when you were talking about it because, like, it's, like, exciting that I'm going to be doing that with my daughter and any other siblings that come.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah. So, okay, so 22 years of age, he was still sleeping with his dad. Like, I don't know, from your experience, do children all of a sudden, on their own accord, do they start wanting to have their own bed at any point? Or, like,
Of course. They every child, we're going back now to what we were talking about earlier about the built-in timetable. Every child has a built-in timetable, and if we can just trust that, you know?
Right.
Jason, you know, we were co-sleeping every night, and I thought it would kind of last forever. And then one day when he was 12, he said, I think I'll sleep alone tonight. And that was his timetable. You know, and didn't bother me that he had had 12 years of feeling secure at night. It's all these parenting books, it's like they assume that you have to be a good parent all day long and then ignore them all night long. It just doesn't make any sense, you know.
Right.
And it causes so many unnecessary problems. You know, it frightens children and, you know, siblings who aren't bonded, and it's a shame
yeah,
that we've lost that.
I mean, I guess it's pointless to talk about cribs because that's just like, and crying kids to sleep and what happens these days. I mean, it's detrimental, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was that? So what is your question?
That wasn't really a question, but I do have another question. So,
okay.
After he was, your son was 12 years of age and started to sleep alone, did he ever, like, come back after that? Like, every once in a while he would sleep with you, or he would just, like, come in the middle of the night or anything like that?
No, he never did.
Wow.
But children who leave earlier probably would do that. You know, if a child decides at 6, you know, then I would imagine he'd be more likely to come back sometimes. And you know, as long as the child feels welcome,
right?
You know, that's all that's necessary. It's when we start pushing them away. It's, you know, that I have this discussion a lot with clients who, you know, moms who are just so tired at night and they decide that they want to do a nighttime weaning. You know, they'll still nurse during the day, but not at night. And it just backfires. The child just gets so insecure and so worried that he's losing this wonderful thing in his life that he's going to nurse more. And so I just help the client to find other ways that they can get a more restful sleep than stopping the nursing, you know, and the same thing with a parent who forces a child to leave the family bed. They're going to be more insecure, and they're going to keep trying to come back in, of course, because a child needs what he needs, and if that need isn't met fully, then he's going to continue to try and get that need met. As soon as the need is met, then he's free to move on to the next level.
Wow, that's like a powerful statement, you know?
Yeah.
It's so backwards in our society today. So,
oh, yes, all of this, everything I've talked about is backwards. And, you know, that's why I hear so much from clients who say that they tried to go to a local counselor, and it's really hard. You know, I feel sad that there's not more counselors like me out there, because it's the vast majority of counselors and in-laws and neighbors, and, you know, are all saying the same thing. And it's just, it's hard. It's really hard, especially if a family has just moved or something and hasn't met any other friends, doesn't have that kind of support. You know, it's really tough, and especially in North America. I think North America is one of the hardest countries to raise a child in because you're surrounded by all of this mistrust of children.
Right.
It's really makes it really difficult.
And you're mentioning during co-sleeping, like, the siblings get to bond. So I know there's a lot of issues when parents get concerned when they're going to have another child or something, and are they going to take away from the other the child that's already there? I guess co-sleeping can actually aid that process.
Yeah, it can mitigate that, absolutely. And I, of course, Jason's an only child, so I don't have personal experience. But so many of my clients have told me how beautiful it is when they wake up in the middle of the night, and sometimes they'll see the two siblings, you know, hugging each other, smiling at each other, you know, and all of that gets missed if they're sleeping separately. And the one thing that I most warn parents about, is, and it's just a shame that they that anyone ever does this, but so many parents just through ignorance, they just don't know, will take the older, you know, the first child, to move him to another room when they have a new baby, and that's the worst timing to do that.
Right.
The older child is already feeling displaced. And then if he's taken out of the family bed and the baby is in the family bed, that's, you know, obviously going to be grounds for a lot of jealousy and resentment and anger.
Right. Oh, man. Whew. Can you think of any other benefits of co-sleeping?
Well, everyone sleeps better. If they're not sleeping better, then I have lots of suggestions on how to improve the, you know, the night for everybody. One thing that I do recommend, if the children or the parents are restless sleepers, of course, there you need to look at food additives and other kinds of causes for that. But one solution that some families have found to being woken up by other members of the family is to just sell the bed, get rid of the bed or store it, put futons or mattresses on the floor, cover the entire room floor, and that gives everyone more room, and so they're less likely to wake up the other members of family, especially on a mattress with springs. Every movement gets transferred to other people. But if you're on the floor, you don't do that, and it also alleviates the worry about babies falling off the bed because they're already down. And that's the way, you know, millions and millions of families sleep in Asia. They sleep on the floor. Most people in the world sleep on the floor. We think everything that we think in North America is just totally normal is actually very abnormal.
Right.
When you look at the population of the whole world, you know.
That sounds like so much fun. Like, we actually have two beds on our floor. It's not futons though, but like what you're saying, create the whole entire room. It sounds like a playroom. It sounds like a lot of fun.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. So before we go, I'm at your website again, naturalchild.org. I thought maybe I could just read the one quote of the month because I love it so much, and it's sitting right here by Catherine M. Wallace. What do you think?
Okay. Yeah, that's our quote of the month for February. Right?
Yeah. Okay, I'll read it. It says, "Listen earnestly to anything your children want to tell you, no matter what. If you don't listen eagerly to the little stuff when they are little, they won't tell you the big stuff when they are big, because to them, all of it has always been big stuff."
Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes. And that's it. You know, the way you treat them when they're young. You know, if you treat them with respect and give them dignity when they're young, that will continue. You know, the relationship that you establish. If you establish a respectful, loving relationship, there's no reason why it will end at any time. You know, people are so afraid that, oh my gosh, when he's a teenager, watch out. You know, you always hear those kinds of warnings. But the reason that teenagers act out is simply because their needs were not met in their early childhood. And they built up all of this frustration and anger, and they can't express it when they're little. But when they get older and larger and stronger, and then they can express those feelings, and that's when it all comes out. But if those feelings aren't there in the first place, there's nothing to come out. So Jason
right.
has been an absolute joy to live with Jason all these years. You know, the teenage years were just as much fun as any other years.
Wow.
No problems. We haven't had anything that I would begin to call a problem since about age four.
Wow, that's amazing.
From then on, it was just smooth sailing and just so much fun.
Wow.
Total delight.
Yeah, it's all exciting. We just have a brand new newborn, like 3.5 months or 3 months and a week or so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well.
Wonderful age.
Yeah.
Yep. Pay attention to this age. It goes so fast. I can't believe Jason's 31 now.
Yeah, Araya, she was, she's like become double the size already. And like every time I see her, I'm just like, I can't believe it. Like when I'm carrying her, it's just amazing.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, I was wondering what these bumps were under the blanket one morning. And what is that? You know, did I leave something under the blanket? And it was Jason's feet. It was his feet. I just didn't realize he was that tall already, you know.
Right.
Yeah.